Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to be focusing on the resource sector. We're going to start off with a focus more on the metals and precious metals area. Second half of the show, we're going to move over to the energy sector, really with a focus more on the equities here, because I know that's what most of you, our listeners, care about, looking down into the equities, seeing opportunities. And at least right now, we are seeing broadly stocks moving higher. It's a good environment out there for resource investors, but you do still need to be in the right stocks to capture at least the vast majority of these gains. I think we've all seen just how much the juniors have lagged, but they aren't at necessarily their lows that we have seen over the past couple years. To kick off this show, we are chatting with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. I will post a link to Exploration Insights in the show notes. Joe, the gold, silver, they've been off to a pretty good start to kick off the second half of this year. Earlier this week, gold was closing in on $2,500. Silver was above $31 an ounce. A little bit of volatility throughout the week, but overall, the stocks have done pretty well, but it has been led by some of the bigger stocks, which, hey, you can make the argument that's a sign of potentially an early or mid-stage bull market. Joe, you were just at a conference down in Boca Raton put on by our good friend Rick Rule. He used to hold this conference in Vancouver, now moved it to a sunnier part of the world. Joe, what was your takeaway from the conference? What were some of the major themes you heard?
Well, it was a good conference, and that conference is as much or more about the people attending than the companies that attend. And I mean, and I think that's what's attractive to the companies that go. It's not an inexpensive conference, given the location in Boca Raton, and everything is not cheap there. But I mean, you get the exposure to a lot of probably high net worth individuals that are actually keen on the sector, mostly, I would say, precious. But they do hear a lot from other critical minerals and companies. I'm not sure how many hundreds of people were there, but I think it was well attended. There's a lot of macro input into that that people enjoy, and company presentations, breakout lunches, and things like that. But yeah, I think the main reason I go there is for the attendees, high net worth individuals that are keen on the mining industry, and from the feedback from the companies that have booths, that they don't know who they're talking to and how big their so-called books are. But when they talk to the right individuals, they could see buying that day on higher than average volume. And so back in the day, we used to see this where you would go to a conference and you could see buying on the back of it. We don't see many conferences like that. The Rick Rule Symposium, a natural resource symposium in Boca, is still one of those.
Well, Joe, as far as the sector itself, when you're at a convention like that or at a show, a lot of people, at least when we're talking with people, have still been a little upset that the juniors haven't been performing as well as they'd like, considering gold's been making all-time highs and silver broke above 30. But when you look at the mid-tiers and the majors, they actually have responded. To Corey's point, you know, the sector has taken off in the producers first, which is normal. The question I have is, do you think with the higher metals prices for Q2, and it looks like it's setting up that way for Q3 as well, that generalists may start making more note, or maybe some analysts may start making note of the producers actually starting to make money at these prices?
Yeah, I would say if we're talking just generalists, the generalist has to see the argument that, real rates are going to go down. And that's part of why we're having this run in stocks, that they're showing some beta to the gold price. Because the gold price increase, some of it is coming from the idea that the U.S. Federal Reserve might have its first rate cut in this cycle coming in September. Remember, when we started at the end of last year, the idea was that we would have 6 interest rate cuts by the U.S. Federal Reserve in 2024. And, you know, the stocks did well in the beginning of the year thinking like that. As those cuts weren't coming, equities didn't do so well, precious metal equities. But the gold price stayed up and actually went up even further because of central bank demand. Again, I think we've had this conversation before where central bank demand and purchases don't bleed over into equities. Whereas if it's institutional equity, generalists buying gold ETFs, that will spill over into major producers that offer dividends and to intermediate producers and eventually down the food chain to the juniors and opening up a financing window potentially for non-cash flowing juniors. We haven't seen that, which what was happening in the first part of this year or the latter part of last year until really more recently, where we've seen the indications that inflation is coming down and unemployment is going up. So that might make the Federal Reserve cut rates in September. But problematically, we have the U.S. presidential elections coming in November, and there is some push there, political push, though this shouldn't be a political reason to cut or not cut, not to have a rate cut before the actual election, which is in November. And so there is a bit of a underlying theme there that might lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to potentially wait for a rate cut until the actual election. But right now, there's definitely institutional equities coming in. There's gold going back up. And I'm sure now we've had ETF inflows now, and that's bleeding over into equities. Because the last couple of months, we haven't seen a lot of central bank buying by the Chinese.
Joe, one thing we hear all the time about is that to get generalists into the market, we need a market correction, a market crash. I find it very interesting that over the past couple of years, as gold has went up about 50%, over 50%, it's actually followed pace with something like the S&P. That ratio is chopped around, but it's pretty much flat over the last couple of years. The underlying stocks, now they have gone up a bit more, so those have outperformed. Is there an environment here where if the markets do well, money naturally can come over to the precious metals and investors have that more risk-on attitude? Or do you believe in the commentary that markets need to crash and that is what brings investors into the underlying gold stocks?
Okay, so there's a few things to unpack there. So one is the gold price relationship with the S&P 500. And so a lot of the movement in the S&P 500 has also been related to the rate cuts, because the valuation of stocks is still, maybe archaically, still related to net present value of projected free cash flow. And if you lower the discount rate, which is related to the risk-free rate, which would be the benchmark rates. If those go down, then theoretically the valuation of stocks go up. So if real rates go down, that should be better for those companies that are trading on the S&P 500. At the same time, that's good for gold. What I've noticed that there's days when gold does really well, but the precious metal equity beta is not very good. And that's because a component of equities requires for the whole market to do well. And so you could have a bad day in the market, good day for gold price, but the precious metals equities are not performing that well because the entire market is down. So sometimes, like, to get a really good beta, you need a combination of positive market sentiment as well as positive moves in gold at the same time for precious metals equities, especially the major ones, to do well.
Well, Joe, another thing that gets the animal spirits going in the sector is M&A. And we have talked to you in the past about a lot of M&A deals that we were seeing, but we're still not seeing that big wave. You would think at $2,400, almost $2,500 gold and 30 plus silver that some of these companies would be in acquisition mode and start picking up either single asset producers or big development projects, because they're more than economical now as far as all of the studies that have been done on these. Do you think that we'll see a bigger wave of M&A coming down the road, considering where metal prices are today?
That's probably the hope of many, and it's definitely my hope, because the easiest thing to do is buy production, and that would increase your own production. You don't take the risk of permitting. You don't take the risk of capital acceleration, escalation. And you timelines as well. The production is right there. And we've seen that in the copper market, and we'll probably continue to see that in the gold market. What's encouraging as we have seen a project that makes sense, like a Reunion Gold Oko West taken out by G Mining. But unusually, this wasn't a producing company. This was a company that was just on the verge of coming in to first pour at their Tocantinzinho gold project in Brazil. And then they go out and acquire for paper Oko West. I mean, I think it was a good purchase. And I think the combination might be a future M&A takeout. So I'm sure that the people that own Reunion, a lot of them held their G Mining converted shares. And I think that's probably a company that's growing in terms of production, because Tocantinzinho will be in production. And these guys are really, you know, first-rate developers. So they don't mind taking that development risk, and they have a lower cost of capital because they're so good at what they do. And that kind of jungle environment, they've done very well building projects for Newmont and Marion in Suriname, Fruta del Norte in Ecuador, and other projects, and also Tocantinzinho, their own project in Brazil, and now this one, potentially Oko West in Guyana. But I'd like to see more of that, but I think there's probably still some reticence because of, especially if a project isn't permitted yet, and potential capital escalation. So they're forcing a lot of these development guys to have a lot more of their de-risking done. Whether it's a PFS, pre-feasibility study, or a feasibility study, questions about metallurgy, more questions probably about social license to operate and permitting, to know that you can actually build it in the timeline you suspect. And so that's probably more of the reticence for M&A on the development space.
So do you see any hope for exploration companies, those that maybe just have a resource or simply a PEA, to get taken over? Or is this still just a game where you either need to be built or so far down the road that those are the ones that are going to be still the targets over the next, who knows, couple years?
Yeah, I think with Oko West, they didn't have anything more than a scoping study. But the thing is, the company that was acquiring them was so confident in their own ability to decipher the numbers and come up with their own conclusion, as opposed to using potentially that scoping study, because they were comfortable building projects in that environment. They could come up with numbers that actually made sense to them. Not all companies could do that in their acquisition. Most corporate development, I won't say they're lazy, because I did work in corporate development for Newmont. We did work hard, but most of the time you work hard and it's a negative outcome, meaning you don't make an M&A transaction, but you still work about the same level to get a negative result. So everybody, I can guarantee you, is looking at everything and already come to their conclusions. But I don't know how many projects that the gold price will change their conclusion. There might be a fatal flaw in some of these that they will never get acquired, that we might not know, but the companies know. The higher gold price, as we talked about before, might make some of their own projects more viable without the acquisition. But right now, as we know, the acquisition cost is not the issue. They're not expensive, these projects, these companies. The risk is, and the cost is, on the capital and on the timeline in terms of permitting. You really have to be comfortable with that. And you got to be comfortable with the jurisdiction. So if you don't work in that jurisdiction, that's another hurdle you got to get over, because then that's a standalone, but also a standalone in a new jurisdiction for you. The M&A would probably happen more for projects near other people's facilities, because we know it's hard to permit. So if you already got a permitted facility and tailings, to acquire an asset nearby that you can feed into your plant as your own mine is dwindling with respect to resources or reserves, that's an easy acquisition without potentially doing a lot of work in terms of permitting, social license operate, or capital, because they know they have a comparative advantage of getting it. So yeah, it's different for every project, I would say. And sometimes we've seen like companies with byproducts that have some kind of critical mineral have a little bit of an advantage. Like we saw that one for Perpetua, where I think it was the Export-Import Bank had signed a high-level letter of intent to potentially give them about $800 million out of, I don't know, their billion plus required upfront capital to build that project because of their antimony byproduct credit. So, you know, for some gold companies who have a critical mineral sort of bent to them with respect to the byproduct, you know, they might have a comparative advantage in terms of funding right now in this market as well.
Well, Joe, you mentioned that before the call, we had a discussion about some of the majors and mid-tiers that bought projects in the past or have development projects in their pipeline that were not economical at lower prices that actually could start creeping into economical projects now at these higher metals prices. But you brought up a great point I'd love you to share with our audience about what happened with Newmont when they did that in the past, and that it's not a, it, sometimes it's a zero-sum gain. So, but I just wonder how that ties into M&A with all these companies that have reserves that were written down in the past. As they bring them back on, could that be preventing them looking at new deals as well?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's prevented from looking at new deals, because that's the job of corporate development, is to look at everything. And I'm sure at the upcoming Precious Metals Summit in September, there'll be a lot of tire kicking there. But in terms of what we discussed prior to the interview, is like I did this little work through Twitter. Sometimes you get good questions, and somebody noted what happened to Newmont's gold reserves. And so a couple of years ago, Newmont had their reserves quoted, I think, at 1200 or 1250. And then they usually, with their reserve statement, show a sensitivity. Okay, if the gold price goes up by X, the reserves will be higher by Y. And then they show that $200, $300 per ounce higher and lower. And so when you look at that number, I believe for the reserve that they ended up upgrading from 1250, I think it was to 1400. In the old sensitivity, that would have added, I believe, about 10 million ounces potentially to their reserves without apparently batting an eye. But when they actually did it, and I talked about this in this capital market short course I conduct with some friends of mine at the roundup in January, if it wasn't for the acquisition of Yanacocha from Buenaventura to up their proportion to 100% of that asset in Peru, their reserves would have been flat, even though they increased the gold price. One of the attendees there was from Newmont, and basically he said most of that was basically the costs had gone up so much that those were not reserves anymore, that they thought back in the old, several years ago when they did the sensitivity, that they would be. So that's another thing we got to look for, is this cost creep. And I think the biggest cost jump escalation was during COVID. That's hopefully moderating. And that's the hope for the next quarter of financials coming out, to see if we see that margin actually expanding as opposed to shrinking with these guys. So if we see that combination of lower, the trend for a lower real rate, institutional equity getting into gold and spilling over into gold equities, the fact that those gold equities would be seeing higher margins potentially with moderating costs, that would be really where the betas would really come back in to play.
Yeah, look, we should be seeing better margins. We should be seeing everything being better in terms of the balance sheet, but it was getting better just in the last few quarters anyway. Joe, one of the big problems, I think, with M&A is the fact that these majors, the ones with money, are in the driver's seat. A lot of these development plays still have that financing risk because there just isn't that much money to, I guess, build these things, or quite frankly, the market caps of these companies. When you look at the building costs compared to market caps, it's a head scratcher in terms of how these companies are going to fund it. But we did have a financing package announced a little while ago, but we haven't chatted with you about it. That's from Skeena Resources. They put together with Orion a mixture of products to finance that build. Does that entice or force the majors then to make a deal if they were going to make a deal rather than sitting on the sidelines?
So if we take Skeena and compare it to a Pretium and Brucejack, so Pretium and Brucejack did exactly the same sort of blend. I mean, not exactly with respect to terms, because that was obviously a long time ago, but a mixed part of financing, part equity, part debt, part stream. And I'm not sure if there was an offtake. I believe there was an offtake on Brucejack. So that combination to fund their project development, because the Brucejack guys were building and they were builders, and they thought they could bring this thing into production. Because at that time, because of the resource risk with Brucejack, nobody wanted to acquire it. But they proved that the asset could work at a higher throughput and lowering the expectations of annual gold production. They managed to change that higher cost debt into something more reasonable. And then they also bought down the stream. And then they created a situation in terms of production success, steady state operations, good jurisdiction, good social license to operate with the First Nations there. I think it was Tahltan, that they were acquired by Newcrest. And Newcrest by that time had some synergy because at that time they owned Red Chris. So that all worked out perfectly, I believe, from a risky resource project. But they needed 2 or 3 years, probably 3 to 4 years, to prove to a major that it actually worked. And they changed their financing structure to not be so burdensome. And because their cost of capital for a project in BC was easily over 16%. And that's not what you think about when because everyone discounts these things at 5%. Why should a project in BC that's permitted have that big of a discount? And that was all resource risk. So if you look at Skeena, they, I think, have to do the same thing. They have to get into production, build it, and then prove that it works. The difference probably is in the deleterious elements in the Skeena. I mean, the Skeena is obviously a very high-grade open-pit gold project with silver. The issue would be the mercury, the antimony, whatever else they have in those in their deposit that they have to work on. That's a liability that potentially some companies don't want. That's a risk that Brucejack didn't have.
Yeah, we've talked to Walter about that before, and he said that they've worked through a lot of those metallurgical studies and have shown that there is a pathway to dealing with those credits and debits in the metallurgy in a positive way. But we'll see how it goes. I guess the question is, we're highlighting Skeena because we haven't seen a lot of these deals, Joe. Why are there not more of these development companies when there's a couple dozen that have millions of ounces of gold in the ground? They've done their studies. Why are they not putting together capital stacks like this and trying to do the same thing? Do you think there's a bigger problem? Is it the cost of capital has gone up because of interest rates, or is it that their market caps are just so low that they can't bring in enough equity? Why are there not more companies putting their hand up and saying, hey, we'd like to be next?
Well, the problem is that you can't do 100% debt. You can't do 100% stream. You have to go to the market. And the market for development plays, the way the retail sector is right now, the retail sector prefers the first entry point on your theoretical Lassonde curve, which is more exploration. They don't want to take the risk on the development side. And that's been a historic relationship. And so for them, it's hard to get that equity part. And so what Skeena has done with that more debt package, what Pretium did was get around equity at this point, because the equity right now is fairly expensive in terms of for development plays. And these guys obviously believe that they can build a project. Most companies, juniors, do not have the people to build a project. And so they just sit there. So unless they can build it themselves, show that they can build it, most of these M&As want them to get closer to the end game. Like I remember with Long Canyon, which was an open pit heap leach, high grade, great recovery in Nevada, not far from Elko. That deposit, they needed to do some de-risking as well. They secured water, they advanced permitting, they had social license with the local ranchers. Frontier divested their uranium assets. Frontier purchased AUX to consolidate the ownership of the project. So they made it clean, which allowed a company like Newmont to take it out. I'm sure that acquisition took about a year to come to fruition. So there might be some acquisitions out there that people have been looking at, and that's just how long some of these companies take to act.
Yeah, we've heard that. Hey, that hasn't been a change in the market. These companies can take a while. The larger they are, the slower they move. Joe, big picture for this market, how do you classify it? As we've said, the majors, the mid-tiers, those have started to move. The juniors still haven't moved, but gold is continuously hitting all-time highs, and silver has hit some multi-year highs, especially above that magical almost $30 an ounce level. Is this mid-cycle bull market? Just what are your thoughts on the stage of the market that we're in right now?
For me, if we're just talking gold, it'll all be around, the direction of real rates. And we have the economy or the economic indicators telling us that the U.S. Federal Reserve is primed to move with respect to cutting. Not at the pace we thought or people had predicted or projected at the end of last year for 2024, but still something happening. I mean, directionally, that's good for gold. And if we get that movement, that'll be good for precious metals. And like I said, if it's protracted, that'll get all the way down to the juniors and open up a financing window, hopefully for people coming in January next year. The problem is, again, U.S. presidential election, there's been a lot of chaos, and probably gold has also been supported on the back of temporary sort of safe haven asset demand on the back of the assassination attempt on one of the candidates. So all that uncertainty is probably also helping gold right now and bringing people in even without the real rate argument. And that could also convert into equities. But there's so much going on now, it's hard to predict a long-term trend right now. But I think you're positioned with respect to the companies to pick those companies with good balance sheets, good assets, and jurisdictions you like to start loading up on those, because I think they're poised for something major. Because in the end, even if the institutional equities aren't there, these guys will still be spewing out a lot of cash flow, because in the end, they're looking at the gold price. So producers will do well. And I have, for that exposure and to mitigate any cost creep, I've gone more to junior cash flowing royalty companies. That's been my way of playing it.
Interesting. Well, look, a lot is going in the favor of the precious metals right now, and some of the stocks too, even from a technical charting basis. So right now is a good time for the sector, but it's always hard to project out multiple years. As much as people try to do that and throw whatever numbers they want, at least we can say that there have been some gains in this sector. It's gone along with a lot of other areas also moving higher and money coming in. Who knows where it's coming from? But the fact of the matter is we have seen some money coming in, and we have seen some better volume in GDX and GDXJ, especially on some up days. Joe, it's always great chatting with you. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to share your insights on this market. As I mentioned, I'll post a link to Exploration Insights in the show notes so you can learn more about what Joe's writing about on a regular basis. Joe, thank you very much for you taking some time on this weekend show.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.